Chapter 18. So that was it? Archer said derisively. I didn't know he was here, Madame Olenska murmured. Her hand still clung to Archer's, but he drew away from her, and walking out into the passage threw open the door of the house. Hello, Beaufort, this way. Madame Olenska was expecting you, he said. During his journey back to New York the next morning, Archer relived with a fatiguing vividness his last moments at Skuytercliff. Beaufort, though clearly annoyed at finding him with Madame Olenska, had, as usual, carried off the situation high-handedly. His way of ignoring people whose presence inconvenienced him actually gave them, if they were sensitive to it, a feeling of invisibility, of non-existence. Archer, as the three strolled back through the park, was aware of this odd sense of disembodiment, and humbling as it was to his vanity it gave him the ghostly advantage of observing unobserved. Beaufort had entered the little house with his usual easy assurance, but he could not smile away the vertical line between his eyes. It was fairly clear that Madame Olenska had not known that he was coming, though her words to Archer had hinted at the possibility. At any rate, as he had evidently not told him where she was going when she left New York, and her unexplained departure had exasperated him. The ostensible reason of his appearance was the discovery, the very night before, of a perfect little house, not in the market, which was really just the thing for her, but would be snapped up instantly if she didn't take it. And he was loud in mock reproaches for the dance as he had led him in running away just as he had found it. If only this new dodge for talking along a wire had been a little bit nearer perfection, I might have told you all this from town, and been toasting my toes before the club fire at this minute, instead of tramping after you through the snow, he grumbled, disguising a real irritation under the pretense of it. And at this opening Madame Olenska twisted the talk away to the fantastic possibility that they might one day actually converse with each other from street to street, or even, incredible dream, from one town to another. This struck from all three allusions to Edgar Poe and Jules Verne, and such platitudes as naturally rise to the lips of the most intelligent, when they are talking against time, and dealing with a new invention in which it would seem ingenuous to believe too soon. And the question of the telephone carried them safely back to the big house. Mrs. van der Luyden had not yet returned, and Archer took his leave and walked off to fetch the cutter, while Beaufort followed the Countess Olenska indoors. It was probable that, little as the van der Luydens encouraged unannounced visits, he could count on being asked to dine, and sent back to the station, to catch the 9 o'clock train. But more than that he would certainly not get, for it would be inconceivable to his hosts that a gentleman traveling without luggage should wish to spend the night, and distasteful to them to propose it to a person with whom they were on terms of such limited cordiality as Beaufort. Beaufort knew all this, and must have foreseen it, and his taking the long journey for so small a reward gave the measure of his impatience. He was undeniably in pursuit of the Countess Olenska, and Beaufort had only one object in view in his pursuit of pretty women. His dull and childless home had long since palled on him, and in addition to more permanent consolations he was always in quest of amorous adventures in his own set. This was the man from whom Madame Olenska was avowedly flying. The question was whether as he had fled, because his importunities displeased her, or because she did not wholly trust herself to resist them, unless, indeed, all her talk of flight had been a blind, and her departure no more than a maneuver. Archer did not really believe this. Little as he had actually seen of Madame Olenska, he was beginning to think that he could read her face, and if not her face, her voice, and both had betrayed annoyance, and even dismay, at Beaufort's sudden appearance. But, after all, if this were the case, was it not worse than if as he had left New York for the express purpose of meeting him? If as he had done that, she ceased to be an object of interest, she threw in her lot with the vulgarest of dissemblers. A woman engaged in a love affair with Beaufort lost herself irretrievably. No, it was worse a thousand times if, judging Beaufort, and probably despising him, she was yet drawn to him by all that gave him an advantage over the other men about her. His habit of two continents and two societies, his familiar association with artists and actors and people generally in the world's eye, and his careless contempt for local prejudices. Beaufort was vulgar, he was uneducated, he was purse-proud. But the circumstances of his life, and a certain native shrewdness, made him better worth talking to than many men, morally and socially his betters, whose horizon was bounded by the Battery and the Central Park. How should anyone coming from a wider world not feel the difference, and be attracted by it? Madame Olenska, in a burst of irritation, had said to Archer that he and she did not talk the same language, and the young man knew that in some respects this was true. But Beaufort understood every turn of her dialect, and spoke it fluently. His view of life, his tone, his attitude, were merely a coarser reflection of those revealed in Count Olenski's letter. This might seem to be to his disadvantage with Count Olenski's wife, but Archer was too intelligent to think that a young woman like Ellen Olenska would necessarily recoil from everything that reminded her of her past. She might believe herself wholly in revolt against it, but what had charmed her in it would still charm her, even though it were against her will. Thus, with a painful impartiality, did the young man make out the case for Beaufort, and for Beaufort's victim. A longing to enlighten her was strong in him, and there were moments when he imagined that all she asked was to be enlightened. That evening he unpacked his books from London. The box was full of things he had been waiting for impatiently. A new volume of Herbert Spencer, another collection of the prolific Elphinstadt's brilliant tales, and a novel called Idlemerch, as to which there had lately been interesting things said in the reviews. He had declined three dinner invitations in favor of this feast, but though he turned the pages with the sensuous joy of the book lover, he did not know what he was reading, and one book after another dropped from his hand. Suddenly, among them, he lit on a small volume of verse which he had ordered, because the name had attracted him. The House of Life. He took it up, and found himself plunged in an atmosphere unlike any he had ever breathed in books, so warm, so rich, and yet so ineffably tender, that it gave a new and haunting beauty to the most elementary of human passions. All through the night he pursued through those enchanted pages the vision of a woman who had the face of Ellen Olenska, but when he woke the next morning, and looked out at the brownstone houses across the street, and thought of his desk in Mr. Letterblair's office, and the family pew in Grace Church, his hour in the park of Skuytercliff became as far outside the pale of probability as the visions of the night. Mercy, how pale you look, Newland. Janie commented over the coffee cups at breakfast, and his mother added, Newland, dear, I've noticed lately that you've been coughing. I do hope you're not letting yourself be overworked. For it was the conviction of both ladies that, under the iron despotism of his senior partners, the young man's life was spent in the most exhausting professional labors, and he had never thought it necessary to undeceive them. The next two or three days dragged by heavily. The taste of the usual was like cinders in his mouth, and there were moments when he felt as if he were being buried alive under his future. He heard nothing of the Countess Olenska, or of the perfect little house, and though he met Beaufort at the club they merely nodded at each other across the whist tables. It was not till the fourth evening that he found a note awaiting him on his return home. Home late tomorrow. I must explain to you, Ellen. These were the only words it contained. The young man, who was dining out, thrust the note into his pocket, smiling a little at the Frenchness of the to you. After dinner he went to a play, and it was not until his return home, after midnight, that he drew Madame Olenska's missive out again, and reread it slowly a number of times. There were several ways of answering it, and he gave considerable thought to each one during the watches of an agitated night. that on which, when morning came, he finally decided, was to pitch some clothes into a portmanteau, and jump on board a boat that was leaving that very afternoon for St. Augustine. XVI. When Archer walked down the sandy main street of St. Augustine to the house which had been pointed out to him as Mr. Welland's, and saw May Welland standing under a magnolia with the sun in her hair, he wondered why he had waited so long to come. Here was the truth, here was reality, here was the life that belonged to him, and he, who fancied himself so scornful of arbitrary restraints, had been afraid to break away from his desk because of what people might think of his stealing a holiday. Her first exclamation was, "Ewland, has anything happened?" And it occurred to him that it would have been more eminent if as he had instantly read in his eyes why he had come. But when he answered, "S, I found I had to see you," her happy blushes took the chill from her surprise, and he saw how easily he would be forgiven, and how soon even Mr. Letterblair's mild disapproval would be smiled away by a tolerant family. Early as it was, the main street was no place for any but formal greetings, and Archer longed to be alone with May, and to pour out all his tenderness and his impatience. It still lacked an hour to the late Welland breakfast time, and instead of asking him to come in, she proposed that they should walk out to an old orange garden beyond the town. As he had just been for a row on the river, and the sun, that netted the little waves with gold, seemed to have caught her in its meshes. Across the warm brown of her cheek her blown hair glittered like silver wire, and her eyes too looked lighter, almost pale in their youthful limpidity. As she walked beside Archer with her long swinging gait, her face wore the vacant serenity of a young marble athlete. To Archer's strained nerves the vision was as soothing as the sight of the blue sky and the lazy river. They sat down on a bench under the orange trees, and he put his arm about her and kissed her. It was like drinking at a cold spring with the sun on it, but his pressure may have been more vehement than he had intended, for the blood rose to her face, and she drew back, as if he had startled her. "What is it?" he asked, smiling, and she looked at him with surprise, and answered, "Owing." A slight embarrassment fell on them, and her hand slipped out of his. It was the only time that he had kissed her on the lips except for their fugitive embrace in the Beaufort Conservatory, and he saw that she was disturbed and shaken out of her cool boyish composure. "Tell me what you do all day," he said, crossing his arms under his tilted back head and pushing his hat forward to screen the sun dazzle. To let her talk about familiar and simple things was the easiest way of carrying on his own independent train of thought, and he sat listening to her simple chronicle of swimming, sailing, and riding, varied by an occasional dance at the primitive inn, when a man of war came in. A few pleasant people from Philadelphia and Baltimore were picnicking at the inn, and the Selfridge Marys had come down for 3 weeks, because Kate Mary had had bronchitis. They were planning to lay out a lawn tennis court on the sands, but no one but Kate and May had rackets, and most of the people had not even heard of the game. All this kept her very busy, and as he had not had time to do more than look at the little vellum book that Archer had sent her the week before, the Onnets from the Portuguese, but she was learning by heart how they brought the good news from Ghent to Aix, because it was one of the first things he had ever read to her, and it amused her to be able to tell him that Kate Mary had never even heard of a poet called Robert Browning. Presently she started up, exclaiming that they would be late for breakfast, and they hurried back to the tumble-down house with its pointless porch and unpruned hedge of plumbago and pink geraniums, where the Willands were installed for the winter. Mr. Willand's sensitive domesticity shrank from the discomforts of the slovenly southern hotel, and at immense expense, and in face of almost insuperable difficulties, Mrs. Willand was obliged, year after year, to improvise an establishment partly made up of discontented New York servants, and partly drawn from the local African supply. "The doctors want my husband to feel that he is in his own home," Otherwise he would be so wretched that the climate would not do him any good, she explained. Winter after winter, to the sympathizing Philadelphians and Baltimoreans, and Mr. Welland, beaming across a breakfast table miraculously supplied with the most varied delicacies, was presently saying to Archer, "You see, my dear fellow, we camp, we literally camp. I tell my wife and May that I want to teach them how." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.